Hello and welcome to Adapt Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Claire O'Connell, and in this episode, we're talking about geopolitics and AI regulation.
From the Adapt Centre at Trinity College, this is Adapt Radio, presenting groundbreaking innovations one conversation at a time.
Now, the European Union's AI Act is blazing a trail as the first ever legal framework on AI. But the technology is evolving quickly. So what challenges do regulators face when it comes to adapting to AI? And how can they bring tough conversations about AI's capabilities to the global stage? To find out more, we are going to hear from Dragos Tudorake, who is a member of the European Parliament, and he's one of the architects of the AI Act. He spoke at a recent event in Trinity College Dublin about the geopolitics of AI. He explained how the EU is positioning itself as a global leader in AI governance and why this matters for everyone, not just the policymakers. Dragos spoke about the delicate balance between the fostering innovation and protecting society and why he believes the EU can gain a competitive edge in the global AI race if it plays its cards right. The bottom line? As AI's role in society grows, there needs to be an understanding of the technology, policy and global power dynamics. Let's listen to MEP Dragos Tudorake's talk, where he asks some big questions about our AI-driven future.
There are many ways of entering this conversation about geopolitics, but I thought the best way would be to start with the AI Act. Not because, of course, I'm subjective to it and I like it, because I worked on it, but I think the AI Act is the first and the best manifestation of European Union thinking geopolitically about artificial intelligence. It was the EU 5 years ago who understood very well and anticipated very well how AI is going to unfold, how impactful it's going to be for our lives, for society, for economy, who understood and looked into the future to see the benefits as well as the perils, and also who anticipated rather well how the global AI race is going to unfold, how important and impactful that race is going to be as well. So the Act itself is not just a piece of legislation. It's not just a bunch of rules and standards on the back of those rules. It is a very powerful, from my point of view, statement of purpose, statement of intent, very political, very geopolitical, because EU has been basically saying to the world, this is a model of how you govern this transformative technology that is going to change the future. So again, when looking at the Act, just to a large extent, the way GDPR pretty much represented a model of how you govern privacy in a digital democracy, in the same way, but times 10, the AI Act is a model of how you govern a technology in a democracy, a technology that, again, is so important and has such a tremendous impact. But I'm going to get to the impact and to the geopolitics later. In terms of the AI Act, a few things that I still want to say at the beginning, because I think it's important. It's important to understand also the journey. I'm not going to get into the details of the journey itself. If you want, in the Q&A or in the panel, I can go deeper into the content. But I want to speak for 1 minute about the process for us as policymakers, because I think it's very important. It illustrates to a large extent what I think is going to happen also with society. 5 years ago, as a member of parliament entering the EU parliament in Brussels for the first time, I knew zero about AI, nothing. I'm a lawyer. I worked on law enforcement, migration, border management, fighting crime for most of my life. But I was concerned when I came in about the future. I was concerned about the geopolitical impact of a technology that I could see was starting to shape up a lot of what we will be doing. So I said, I want to be part of that. But I looked to the left, I looked to the right, to my fellow policymakers in the European Parliament, and I realized that pretty much everyone was like me, knew nothing about AI, but realized also the importance of it. So we said we have to start learning because it is the only way we're going to be capable as policymakers to do our jobs, to respond to the legitimate expectation of society that we would be stepping up to the challenge of providing an answer for that need for governance. So, together with my fellow MEPs, we said, okay, so let's start learning. We've established a special committee on AI. I had the honor of chairing that committee. We've learned through, it was COVID, but we've learned through 2 years of talking to everyone that we could find from every walk of science, society, business, civil society, academia, that could tell us, educate us about the ins and outs of AI in every possible field, goods and bads, benefits and risks. And after those 2 years, we felt, aha, now we're better. Now we're ready. Now we start understanding. So now we can actually endeavor to start writing rules. And again, I wanted to tell you this because I think society at large will have to do a very similar exercise, not to the same level of detail, because society, the regular citizen out there doesn't have to understand it that well. But still, we have to also think very seriously on how we start bringing the society on board in understanding how much AI is going to mean in their lives in the years to come. Few words also on state of play, because I think it's quite important to understand the calendar and also next steps and what I consider to be the big challenges for the implementation of the AI Act before, again, moving into the geopolitical discussion. So, terms of adoption, done and dusted, signed, voted, nothing more to be done, just publication, hopefully in the next 2 to 3 weeks, at which time the clock starts ticking. And the clock will start ticking differently. There are about 5 different checkpoints in the transitional period before the law becomes law. 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 24 months, 36 months. 6 months from the moment of publication, the prohibitions in the Act will start being applicable. 9 months for the code of practice for the Gen AI, the top models that you heard about. 12 months, we start policing the top models of AI at the EU level. Exclusive competence for the EU AI office in enforcing the rules for the Gemini and the ChatGPT and the Claude out there. 24 months, the rest of the regulation, the high-risk framework that is going to be, by the way, implemented at national level. So 24 months is in there because we realized that we had to give time to the member states, to the governments, to set up the national regulators, to give them space, time, to bring in resources, expertise, to prepare for a very, very important role that they will play in terms of how implementation will be done. I'll speak of that in a second. And then 36 months for the AI that is embedded in devices such as medical devices, that is when the rules will be applicable to them. So that's a bit the calendar. You'd see, and many say, well, why is it taking so long when the needs are now and the risks are today? It's true. But again, it's very, very complex governance that we have set up. There's no precedent for it. It's being done for the first time. So there needs to be a time given first of all, to the subjects of the law, to all the businesses out there who will be finding themselves in the scope of the regulation. Not all of them, by the way, but still, those who will be coming under the scope of the regulation, they need to prepare for that moment. And also, as I said earlier, governments themselves, and also the EU level, by the way, the EU office also, needs to be gearing up to be developing the tools, to acquire the tools, the expertise, the knowledge, the network of contacts, and bring communities that can help in the implementation and in the deployment of various tools to evaluate models. So all of that needs to be done, and that's why that calendar, the time is needed. Challenges, huge ones. To a large extent, what we have done for the last 4 years was easy. Yes, a lot of negotiations, a lot of forth and back, but that was the easy part. Writing a piece of law is not that hard. Implementing it right, that's the key part. Someone was saying in an event last week, we now have to move from the wow to the how. So far it's been wow. Wow for us as policymakers, wow, negotiating, ooh, how everyone's looking. while also for the businesses to a large extent being amazed at what the technology does, now it becomes real. And implementation will be very real and will make the challenges very real. First, there's a big challenge for the new regulators, huge one. Not only because they'll have to understand and learn how to apply the law. That's also the easy part. There is a spirit in this law, and I fought very hard in the negotiations to put this spirit in the law, which is not just about beating the businesses with a stick. It's not just about enforcing a set of rules. The AI Act is also about enabling, understanding the huge relevance, the huge impact that this technology has. And if the regulators at EU level or at national level do not understand the spirit of this law, do not understand that their role is not just to read out of a textbook rules to the company sitting in front of them, but actually their role is to facilitate for that company how it actually understands its societal obligations, how it understands the rules that they have to comply, to help in testing, in bringing a product to the market, again, then all is lost. And what we wanted to achieve with the obligation, to serve two objectives, the objective of, yes, protecting society, but at the same time, stimulating innovation, creativity, all that would be lost. So again, there's going to be a huge challenge for the regulators to get through, to get at the heart of what this regulation is about, and also have the right mindset to know that they have to do that and to know how to do that. Finding the expertise, both at the European level, but also at national level, is going to be very difficult. I don't have to tell anyone how tight of a market this is in terms of talent. And as you could easily anticipate, government salaries are not that sexy. They are neither very attractive in Brussels, I can tell you that. Because you cannot pay an AI wizard that otherwise would get a very handsome salary in Silicon Valley with a regular salary for a civil servant anywhere in Europe. Again, including in Brussels. So that is going to be a big challenge for the regulators to actually have the right talent, have the right skills, have the right people to put in front of those who will be knocking on the door of a sandbox, for example, and say, listen, I came to test my model. If you're going to put a bureaucrat, a lawyer, in the chair, forget it. It's not going to happen. It's not what, again, this regulation is supposed to be about. So again, big challenge for the regulators to get the mindset, to get the skills, to do the work. A big challenge also for the industry itself, for the companies themselves. Not only because they'll have to now work with some rules, but also because they also have to understand that they have a role to play in this new governance. If they don't want that the regulators act as the ones with the stick in the hand, they also have to understand they have to engage differently with the regulator. They have a role to play. And we made sure that in governance of the AI Act, we gave a role to play to companies. We created a dedicated advisory board for that so that industry can sit at the table where the decisions are made, inform those decisions, educate the regulator, bring the reality from out there in the world where the regulator doesn't necessarily see all the time what is happening, bring that reality to the table of the decisions, and that's how then the decisions are relevant, because there'll be constant decisions to be made. That's another thing about the Act. It's a living text, and we've deliberately made it a living text so that it keeps adapting to how the technology and the reality out there will adapt. There's also going to be a huge challenge for the policymakers, such as myself and my colleagues in the new parliament, because we will have to scrutinize this. And also, very importantly, we'll have to abstain from the temptation of regulating further. And I'm saying it with quite a lot of the responsibility of what has been done in the last 5 years. There was a massive body of law that we have put out there. It's not only the Act, the DSA, the DMA, the Data Act, the Data Governance Act, the Gigabit Act. So a lot of acts. All these acts have to land. And they have to land for regulators, they have to land for companies, they have to land for citizens. If we're going to keep on doing more and more acts also in this new cycle, it's not going to be at all easy. So one challenge for the regulator, for the policymakers, will be to actually resist the temptation, although AI is, again, a very hot topic today, and whenever you dingle a hot topic in front of a politician, they tend to grab it. But the challenge will be for them to stop doing it, to take a pause for this cycle and really focus on implementation. And now I'm going to move to the geopolitics, because I said I would talk about geopolitics. And I'll make three claims. The first claim is that AI is the most disruptive technological change in the history of mankind. The second one is that the future will be shaped by those who shape AI and who have the competitive edge on AI. And the third claim will be that EU can have that edge if it knows how to play its cards well. I'll start with the first claim, AI being the most disruptive thing we've seen so far. You heard also from Professor Kelleher earlier, and I've seen comparisons, metaphors about what AI is. Is it equivalent to the fire? Is it equivalent to the steam engine, to the electricity, to many other technological wonders that we as humans produced over the course of our history? The reality is, I think, that AI is a bit bigger than any of those, or bigger than those combined, because it really touches everything. It cuts across everything. It's impacting everything. Take human activity. AI is going to do everything that we know as cognitive tasks, intellectual tasks in our activities, right? From writing emails, answering phone, performing surgery, doing research, you name it. Everything will have an AI that will either match or, in many instances, surpass human potential. We'll have to get to grips with that, including creativity, by the way. We used to have a monopoly on creation so far as humans. We thought we were the only ones that could paint, compose music, do poems. Well, forget that. AI is already doing it quite well. You heard the poem, beautiful. And will most likely be able to do even better. So quite a lot of thinking, quite a lot of impact in terms of how we regard ourselves as humans, the role we play, the value that we add to the activities that we perform. The second is a very profound economical impact. AI is going to upend value chains, manufacturing logics, everything in our economy, every sector. It's an enabling and horizontal technology. It's not sitting in a silo. It's not vertical. It is also vertical as a piece of industry, but it's going to cut across everything. So also economically, it is going to have a huge impact. B2B, B2C, government-to-citizen interaction, all of that will be somewhat governed by AI. And it has to be. It can actually enable that interaction to a large extent. Take governments. A mid-sized nation has about 1 billion transactions between the government and its citizens a year. Imagine if you power that with AI. But that brings me to the third impact on governments and states themselves. States will also be challenged by AI. Social contract will be challenged by AI. The role of the state towards society, towards citizens, will be challenged by AI. States, who usually are very heavy, they are big, big boats turning very slowly in the ocean. And AI moves very fast. Those that create and develop services built on AI are moving much faster than states are used to move. States will have to learn to become themselves platforms if they want to stay relevant for their citizens. If they want to ask for the citizens' votes, and get them right, in 10 years' time, states will have to become and learn to become themselves platforms, provider of AI services and AI-powered services as well. Fifth impact, warfare. I don't need to tell you, because we now see it, unfortunately, live on our tellies every evening. In Ukraine, in Gaza, AI is becoming and is reshaping war as we've known it. Attritable weapon systems, as they are very gingerly called, are going to become the norm in the wars of tomorrow. And attritable autonomous weapon systems can only be powered by AI. So AI will be also becoming the key technology in warfare, another reason why AI is already so important from a geopolitical point of view. I'm going to move to the second claim, which is that those who shape AI are going to shape the future. And again, here, I'm not telling you anything new. You've heard some glimpses already in the previous interventions. If you look at the four key factors in AI, all of those have a geopolitical angle. Start with data. AI without data doesn't exist. So who has the necessary data stocks to remain competitive? AI requires huge amounts of data. We are already running out of it, by the way. So we're starting to produce synthetic data. No one knows exactly how long we can do that and to what effect, by the way, to the AI models. How relevant, what's going to happen with the AI models that are going to be exclusively trained on synthetic data if we run out of regular data. So the data, the amount of data, the availability of data, the composition of the data, very important in the big geopolitical game out there. As Europeans, we have during this cycle also focused a lot on that, and not by accident. The Data Act, the Data Governance Act, all of these things are meant to create the space needed, the resource needed for AI, because you need the data. China has way more. There's also a cultural element here. Language. You heard, it's all about large language models. 57% of the data out there is English. 57. So there's a cultural angle. What happens with the smaller languages? That can be a disadvantage. It can also be an advantage, because there are different schools of thought out there as to how will the future look like. Will the future be dominated only by few very powerful models that are going to be the bedrock of everything and smaller than applications built on top of them? Or there will be a growing demand for more context-suited, culturally adapted smaller models to respond to more particular needs in particular contexts, whether national or ethnic or cultural, so on and so forth, or language. But again, the reality is that if you look at the data stocks and what the data and the data that is available out there, again, there is already and there's going to be a massive competition on who controls and how do you get the data that you need to train. Then is compute. Again, you've heard how relevant compute is. Big problem, first of all, because of the concentration of the market in this respect. We have now woken up to the reality that there is only one company in the world that produces the magical GPUs necessary to train big models. Ooh-ha, great. What does that mean from a geopolitical point of view? Where is the company? Is it normal, good, looking sustainable, looking into the future, that there is only one company in one part of the world that can decide, I'm going to give you the GPUs so you train a model, or I'm going to give you the GPUs and you are going to stand in line. No matter the good idea that you have, but you'll stand in line and I'm going to give you the GPUs you need. So the availability of compute is a big thing. Supercomputers. The US has 150, 60. China, a bit less. In Europe, when we count I think 50 in Germany, 35 in France, 30-something in the Netherlands. That's how we count in Europe. Big mistake. If we want to be relevant and match the 160 in the US and 140 in China, we have to count 35 plus 50 plus 30 plus 20 plus 10. And also how we use it is key. The Germans are mostly using their supercomputers for research. Good. But maybe a bit of diversification would not be bad. So in fact, if we want to be competitive, going back to my third claim soon, about how we stay competitive and how we have the edge, then we have, forget, it's a trap. AI compute sovereignty is a trap at EU level. We have to basically fire with all of our guns in the same way. So we have to pool all of the supercomputers, not only those that are bought with EU money, those are already pooled together. And we're trying to leverage them as much as we can for the benefit of all. But all of the supercomputers that are held out there also by at national level, they have to be networked. And they have to be made available, again, for the creation of good AI and powerful AI if we are to stay competitive. Third, resource energy. I was telling this morning, a company, I'm not going to name it, 2 weeks ago, just bought a nuclear plant, all for itself. So a company bought a nuclear plant because they realized that they need so much power that they can't any longer rely on the national grid. And therefore, why not buy yourself a nuclear plant? So that also speaks of scale and the size of certain companies and how easy or not it is to actually compete with those. But again, what I wanted to say is that AI also takes huge amounts of energy. I saw an estimate that only in the next few years, it's going to grow by one third the need of electricity only on the back of AI, only because of AI. So there needs to be, first of all, I agree, someone was saying earlier that actually we have to look at how AI can help with energy efficiency. And I absolutely agree with that. But again, the electricity taken by AI is going to become itself a geopolitical element. And it is a factor in that equation. And then the last one, and certainly not the least, is talent. I mentioned it earlier, skills and talent. Skills and talent is key. There's going to be a huge battle for talent out there. We're not very good at retaining talent here in Europe, not because we don't produce it. Actually, we are quite good in producing the talent, but we're neither good in keeping it here because we don't have enough beacons to radiate and attract people who want to be working in those places. And also second, because we are not very good at all at managing migration. Look at the landscape of AI and generally who populates the big tech in the US. I don't have to tell you, they are not Americans. So we have to learn here in Europe the benefit of migration for AI and more generally for our economies. So politically, we have to find at some moment, we've been obsessed by this in the wrong way for the last 10 years. And as I said, in my previous life, I used to deal with migration. But we have to, again, get past politically by the obsession that migration is a bad thing. Yes, it has aspects that have to be managed. But again, we're not going to survive in this race if we're not learning to also attract talent from outside of Europe to come and work here. Full stop. Now the last claim, and I'll wrap it there, which is that we at EU level have a shot at breaking the glass ceiling. We do have a shot at being competitive, at staying in the race. We do start with a handicap. There are path dependencies that can't be broken that easily. There are realities out there in the digital economy that, again, we can't change like that. You can't change that the big tech is where it is, that they can actually buy power plants like that. They have a valuation that is bigger than almost every member state's GDP. So that cannot be changed. But we can leverage what we have. We can leverage the AI Act. We have created the model that is an inspiration for many other jurisdictions out there in the world. I can tell you there are many countries in Latin America, many countries in Asia, who are, as we speak, looking at the AI Act, writing their own legislation on the basis of that. That is an advantage. We're going to produce standards in the next 2 years on the back of the AI Act that are very likely to become global standards. That is leverage. That is an advantage. If we manage to inspire with our model others so that, again, our version and the kind of trustworthy AI tools that we're building here are going to become the trustworthy AI tools for many corners of the world out there, that is an advantage that can keep us in the race. But of course, we're not going to win the race only through regulation or through effects of regulation. It would be childish to think we would do so. Which means, and I go back to what I was saying earlier about the challenges of the AI Act, which means that we have to massively focus on actually radiating creativity, innovation, creating the ecosystem, boosting the potential of our economies to develop ourselves AI, and also to use more and more AI in many of the other domains of economic activity out there who will be benefiting from AI. In certain sectors, we're doing well. Smart farming, we are better than the Americans. AI using satellite data and civilian applications using satellite data, we are better than the Americans. Robotics, we are, if not the best in the world, but we are among the top three out there. So there are sectors which have proven to be centers of excellence. We have to replicate that to the level of our whole economy. And again, invest enough so that we can also bring in next to the regulation this advantage, the economical element in it, if we want to make it. And then most importantly, and I'm going to end there, is how to play the global cooperation. From the very beginning, people are always saying, well, Brussels effect, Brussels effect, Brussels effect. And I always said, not enough, not enough, not enough. And also, don't be arrogant about the Brussels effect. It has to be exercised with a lot of wisdom and humility. Yes, it is going to inspire, as I said, other jurisdictions. But no, you don't consider that to be money in the bank. There'll have to be a continuous effort on our side to engage with everyone else out there in building, albeit the race that we're going to be engaged in, albeit that race, there still has to be cooperation, because there will be big questions about the future of AI for which we cannot be the only ones thinking or providing the answer. There needs to be a global governance being developed so that we will be having the place where we give answers to those big existential questions that will come. I'm convinced of that. So there are good signs already. There's cooperation, Trade and Technology Council with the US, Trade and Technology Council with India, with Japan. So the democracies out there are starting to pull together. We had Bletchley Park, and we had the continuation in Seoul 2 weeks ago. We're going to have Paris as the next iteration of the Global AI Summit in February of next year. So there will be venues still, places still, where we can bring in, again, democracies around the table to try and conceive some form of global governance. But it is not only about democracies. Yes, democracies have to be aligned. They have values that they share, and they look at the technology in the same way. Therefore, they are the first to basically try and find some commonality or at least interoperability in the governances that they set up. But it's very important to understand that for the kind of global conversation that will be triggered by, again, leaps that this technology will take, we will need everyone around the table. We will need China at the table. I was one of those, very few, and I was booed when I said last summer that China had to be invited. And actually, I defended the position of the British government deciding to invite China at Bletchley Park. And I said, I think it's a smart idea. Because again, there are conversations for which it's not only about the like-minded and what they think. It is also being as inclusive as you can, and you bring, I hate the word global south, you bring as many of the countries around the globe who are impacted by AI. Africa wants to be at the table, rightly so. Latin America wants to be at the table, rightly so. Southeast Asia wants to be at the table, and rightly so. They have to be part of the conversation as well. And again, if we find the energy and we put the effort in it to develop this global governance, and we'll see what is going to happen in Paris next year. This is one of the ambitions of the French, to conceive, to negotiate, to arrive at some form of global governance by the summit of next year. Then again, we will have the place where we can also deal with the big questions that are yet to come. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention. I hope we'll have a good time.
That was Dragos Tudorache, who is a member of the European Parliament and chair of the Special Committee on Artificial Intelligence in the Digital Age. And he was speaking about the geopolitics of the AI Act. Thank you, Dragos, for a really thought-provoking speech. And if you would like to find out more about his work, I've put some information into the show notes, which you will find in the description area of this podcast. For now, from me, Dr. Claire O'Connell, Sláinte, and thanks for listening to Adapt Radio.
The Adapt Radio podcast is brought to you by the Adapt Centre at Trinity College Dublin. Find out more about their extensive research work at adaptcentre.ie. Join us next time to hear about more groundbreaking innovations. To get new episodes automatically, just click the follow button on your player right now. The Adapt Radio podcast is produced by dustpod.io, with episodes monthly on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.